Healthcare Today is produced and paid for by the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to wdev@radiovermont.com.
Northfield Pharmacy wants to make taking care of your health as easy as possible. That's why they're offering the Johnson & Johnson vaccine right at the pharmacy. This is the one-and-done vaccine, and it's offered on Monday, Tuesday, and Friday from 10 to 4. Register at northfieldpharmacy.com. And talk about easy. Have you tried the Northfield Pharmacy mobile app? You can order refills, set reminders, request renewals, and send messages all from your mobile device. Northfield Pharmacy, an independent pharmacy with a hometown touch. Depot Square, Northfield. At Westview Meadows in Montpelier, their top priority is the health and well-being of their residents and staff. Let's talk with Alan.
It feels like home. Got a lot of pictures, body surfing at the shore, in clamshells. So I feel like I'm home. I have a bedroom and I have a living area, and I feel really safe and protected here. They really have gone overboard to take a conservative approach, which for me is just what I want. The way they've opened things up has been slowly and surely. I feel blessed by having been here the last 6 months.
Westview Meadows at Montpelier, providing a high-quality residential setting for seniors that promotes independence, individuality, choice, and security. Contact them at 223-1068 or go to westviewmeadows.com for apartment options and availability. Westview Meadows, a beautiful place to live.
Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, a weekly exploration of health and wellness topics affecting Vermonters. Brought to you in part by Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. Northfieldpharmacy.com. And Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee-owned and locally committed. Your participation is encouraged. Call with your questions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Good afternoon and welcome to Healthcare Today. I'm Dr. Lewis Myers. As we reach what we hope is the end of the COVID pandemic, or at least the beginning of the end, we are faced with an epidemic which had been facing us before the COVID came on and continues after, and that is the scourge of opioid addiction. In fact, during COVID, it appears that treatment methods that we had used were not working as well, and the opioid addiction problem actually got worse. We have two guests today to talk to us about opioid use disorders or opioid addictions. Dr. Nikki King is on the phone with us from Batesville, Indiana, and someone we know well in Vermont, Dr. Mark Levine, is our Commissioner of Health, will also be joining us. Let me first introduce Ms. King, or Dr. King. Born in the coalfields of southeastern Kentucky, she watched as many in her community suffered from the ravages of opioid addiction. She lost many friends and watched the community nearly come apart. She was able to leave for college, one of the few who did, and eventually got her doctorate degree in healthcare administration at the Medical University of South Carolina. She currently is in Batesville, Indiana, and she's been there since 2015, working at the Margaret Mary Health Center, Community Health Center, where she manages the Behavioral Health and Addiction Services Department. She has, over the past year, has been on a number of national television programs and has also been featured in the Atlantic magazine. Dr. King, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, when we spoke a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned that in some ways Vermont is similar to Kentucky in that we are basically a rural state. Outside of some of the economic drivers of the state, we have a large percentage of people who are hardworking but struggling economically. And certainly we have faced our own problems with opioids. In fact, I believe it was 2014, then Governor Shumlin devoted his entire State of the State speech to the opioid epidemic and began a new phase of treatment, something called the hub and spoke. And we feel like we've made some progress until COVID hit. But I wanted to hear from you about Kentucky and about your early years and what you saw and what made you decide to go into helping take care of people with opioid use disorder.
Sure, yeah. You know, it's funny. You mentioned all those things about Vermont. I actually knew all those things because everyone in our department, despite never having been to Vermont, has a highly above average interest in Vermont because they're all incredible Bernie Sanders fans, so they're all really mad at me right now that I get to do this. But so thank you again for having me on. But yeah, so I grew up in southeastern Kentucky. You know, when I was growing up, when I was like 8 to 10 years old is really when we had the height of the OxyContin epidemic. And a lot of pharmaceutical companies target areas that are very high risk. They have low education, they have much higher than average amount of chronic pain, et cetera, et cetera. The situation was no different. I remember us having some of our first conversations when, you know, frankly, you know, our neighbors and things like that who had been put on OxyContin started to act very strangely and having conversations about, can you become addicted to something that a doctor gives you? Because really, they didn't think that you could. I remember, I grew up primarily with my grandparents and sitting around talking to my mama and papa about, is it possible? And I remember them just being at a total loss for what we were seeing because it just came on. Honestly, it reminded me a lot of COVID. You know, it's like one day you're talking about, could this happen? And the next day it's everyone you know, and it's everywhere, and it's controlling every aspect of your life. And so I saw my first opioid overdose, actually my friend's 13th birthday party. And it occurs to me now looking back that it was funny because I already knew exactly what to do because I'd heard so many people at school talking about their parents overdosing. And, you know, by the time I got to college, it was really eye-opening for me to realize that everywhere wasn't dealing with the drug epidemic at the same level. But now that I've been out of school, it's spreading outwards, you know, and like I said, it really reminds me a lot of any other pandemic. And so I think that this is something that as a country, we're going to have to reckon with.
So you mentioned that you talk about OxyContin and the prescribing practices of physicians and other healthcare providers. And obviously we know now that was a big problem. Huge companies like Purdue Pharma have come under class action lawsuits. And I think in many ways prescribing practices have changed. How was heroin seen in your community? Because, you know, up until, I think really in the 1960s and 1970s, heroin was essentially a drug of the inner cities, often used by minority groups in the inner cities. What was the reaction of people when, in your community in Kentucky, when heroin started to show up?
Honestly, heroin hasn't really been showing up. Heroin didn't start showing up until we really cracked down on the prescription of OxyContin. A lot of people, if they are taking a benzodiazepine and they're just taking a little too much, or they're taking a painkiller written by a doctor and they're taking a little too much, they don't see themselves as addicts because it came from a doctor. And there's less of that now that there's been so much media attention around prescriptions and the dangers of controlled substances and things like that. But back in the day, everybody thought that you could just be straight up snorting your Adderall, but because it came from a doctor, it's not a drug. Whereas something like heroin that you buy from a shady person on the street corner, that's a drug. And we're not addicts here. So that's only very recently been coming around. And I really feel like it's a response to people who already had a pretty severe addiction who've been cut off of their pain medications.
You know, I can tell you from my experience as a medical student, I may have mentioned this on a program some months ago. I was in medical school in the early and mid-1990s, residency shortly after that. And we were taught in medical school that we were undertreating pain. And we were taught that opioids were not addictive if you prescribed them to people that were truly in pain, that those people could not be addicted. We now know that much of that message was being paid for directly or indirectly by some of the big pharmaceutical companies. But it's taken a long time to unwind that message. And you described some of the, you know, some of the effects of that. What about methamphetamine? I know we're talking mostly about opioids, but can you talk a little bit about methamphetamine in your area of the country?
Yeah, so methamphetamine has been on the rise for several years. It's really interesting, actually, to look at some of the research that shows how methamphetamine abuse coincides with areas that have high levels of military recruitment and people coming back home from various wars and different things with that, particularly Vietnam, and how that kind of lets that cat out of the bag. But yes, methamphetamine use is on the rise, and it has been for several years. That one's very difficult, and that one should scare people. You know, we talk a lot about the opioid epidemic because people die from opioids. You know, you see 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds coming in the ER and they overdose and you can't revive them, and it's incredibly traumatic for everyone involved, where someone with methamphetamine use disorder could languish on for years, and even if they die from their disease, it's not always very clear what the cause was. But from my perspective, and again, I'm not a clinician, so I'm not even technically not a clinician. I'm definitely not a clinician, but I can tell you from my perspective, methamphetamine is extremely hard to rehab. The damage that it does to the brain and your ability to feel pleasure normally, so from having a nice slice of cake or watching your kid's graduation or something like that, is just permanently deadened to a point that it makes it extremely difficult to achieve long-term recovery with methamphetamine, particularly without some serious psychiatric intervention. And we live in a country where we're significantly understaffed in psychiatry, and a lot of states don't have Medicaid, which is the primary payer for psychiatry services anywhere that you are. So a lot of people just don't have access to the things that they would need to even be successful long-term with that. That one should scare people. That one should scare people to death.
When you left for college, one, as I mentioned, perhaps one of the few in your community, I'm guessing, that was able to go away to college, and then eventually got a doctorate degree, when you go back to your community, how are you received?
You know, I'm still one of the gang. I think you're probably alluding to, sometimes a lot of communities really tend to ostracize people who maybe get like a higher level of education. You know, I've definitely read about this phenomenon in minority communities. In Eastern Kentucky, once you're Appalachian for life. You know, you're one of us. As long as you talk right, you know, and you don't say Appalachia. If you say Appalachia, you are out.
I'll definitely try and remember that on this show. And tell me about the work you're doing in Indiana now, in Batesville.
So I started here at Margaret Mary back in 2015 as an intern, actually, while I was getting my master's degree at the time. And they actually hired me to analyze data. We became one of the first rural hospitals, the Margaret Mary Hospital, became one of the first rural hospitals to actually be involved in an accountable care organization. So we had a lot of data, basically all payer data, on all of our patients, and absolutely no way to digest that into anything meaningful. So that's what they asked me to do. So I spent an entire summer just combing through thousands and thousands of patient encounters and prescriptions and things like that. And what I ended up finding was a lot of patterns of patient use. And so we were able to identify some unmet patient needs, particularly in the area of frequent flyers in the ER. But the one thing that we kept running our heads up against is we kept having people come into the ER for things like suicidal ideation, panic attacks, you know, depression, overdose, et cetera, mental health issues. And I would see that there was no charges come through for any kind of psychiatry follow-up or therapy follow-up or any kind of, you know, psychiatric medications, because I had all of the payer data. And so when I would follow up with the patients and ask them, where, you know, why hadn't you followed up with a mental health provider that the answer was there aren't any. And so when you looked at the data, and I'd have to go back and look at the actual numbers, but I believe that the ratio of population to mental health providers in our community at that time was something like one provider for every 5,000 citizens. Mm. And so for the very few people who existed in our rural community, there was like three providers, I think. They were just buried. And so the mental health services were just not going to cut it. There just weren't enough. So finally, I found out at a rural hospital, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. You complain enough and they just tell you to do it. So, they charged me with creating our mental health and addiction services departments, which I did. One of the things I found out is that I have come to believe that addiction doesn't exist in a bubble. I don't think anybody just has substance use disorder. It's always, in my experience, a coping mechanism, a poor coping mechanism, but a coping mechanism. And it's almost always a result of things like unresolved childhood trauma or undiagnosed anxiety, depression. Something about their loss is making it so hard for them to cope that heroin seemed like a good option. And a lot of them don't care if they live to see tomorrow because, again, they're already struggling so much that it makes recovery just seem like a pipe dream. And so taking that into account, you have to, in my mind, to have a successful substance use program, you really have to take it back to those social determinants of health and the social safety net. So do they have adequate health care? Do they have adequate housing? Do they have adequate food at home? Do they have adequate support for parenting and things like that, adequate family support? Are they a member of the LGBTQ community or a minority community, which are inherently very difficult things in rural Indiana? Do they have what they need to be successful? And that answer is always no.
You've mentioned some of the mental health issues. Also, I guess we've heard that drug addiction and maybe also a disease of despair, and particularly economic despair in these parts of the country that have been overlooked and have not benefited from some of the other economic drivers.
No, absolutely. And I would say that if you've got an individual who is suicidal, you know, there's still a lot of shame, I think, with suicidality and depression and anxiety. In rural communities, there's still very much a pressure to have this can-do attitude that we're super tough and we can handle anything. But it's really no different than a substance use disorder. You're seeing a different manifestation of the same core problem, which, to your point, is the diseases of despair. And so those can be very difficult to attack all the different things that underline that despair in a rural community. And so I think, you know, in order to do that, you really have to reach out and create partnerships. And, you know, where I really got the inspiration for that was your all hub and spoke model, which I'm incredibly jealous of. And I've tried to replicate that in Indiana in a micro fashion and do what I can with the resources that we have. But yeah, I think that, those are the big issues that are underlying it. We have to talk more about childhood trauma in this country. We have to.
Well, with as you mentioned, Hub and Spoke, we do have Dr. Mark Levine on the other line now, and I'd like to bring him in. Dr. Levine, I'm honored to have him back. He was our first guest on this show back in October when we opened the show in October of last year. Since then, as you know, and even before that, he and Governor Scott have stood shoulder to shoulder, guiding us through the COVID epidemic, and I think in made Vermont one of the safest states in the nation per capita. We're grateful for that. But even before that, Dr. Levine was very closely involved with the opioid epidemic and its treatment. Dr. Levine got his MD degree at Rochester University. He did his residency in internal medicine at the University of Vermont Medical Center and was chief resident there. He did a fellowship at the University of North Carolina in faculty development and went on to be the program director of the internal medicine residency at the University of Vermont Medical Center before becoming our commissioner of health. Dr. Levine, welcome.
Great to be back.
Yes, and also I want to let our listeners know, as always, if you have thoughts or questions, give us a call at 802-244-1777. And Dr. King, if you would stay on the line, because I think we're going to bounce some things off of you again. Dr. Levine, you've had a chance, I think, to listen to much of what Dr. King was saying, and she was just talking about the hub and spoke. Can you, sort of came in on, near the beginning of this. Can you tell the listeners what the hub and spoke is and why it's important?
Absolutely. The hub and spoke is really a model of treatment for opioid use disorder, though it can also be for other drugs as well. But it was designed with the opioid epidemic in mind. And basically what it is it's a bidirectional system. Hubs are kind of in existence to be more of your traditional large treatment centers where people with substance use disorder can go, usually those who need to be more intensively treated, those who are more complex. That means essentially that a hub is a place where one can get methadone, which can only be prescribed by addiction specialists, as well as buprenorphine or Suboxone, which is sort of the mainstay of most outpatient treatment. But the hub and spoke system is an outpatient treatment system. And the specialized care occurs at the hubs. The spokes are actually parts of the primary care enterprise, with to some degree OBGYN and mental health involved as well. So these are office-based practices where somebody with an opioid use disorder might be sitting next door to somebody who's there for a cold or somebody who's there to have their blood pressure managed better. So it's integrated into the healthcare system at large. The only treatments that are usually administered at spokes are buprenorphine or naltrexone, but naltrexone we probably won't talk much about today. It's not a mainstay of treatment currently, though it can be used. The nice thing about the hub-and-spoke system is that patients can move from one to another. So if somebody's needs become less intense and they've been managed at a hub, they can be moved into the spoke setting and become, and again, have their disorder become treated as if it's part of the general healthcare system. Likewise, if a clinician is caring for someone in the spoke system and their needs become more complex, they're a phone call away from the consultant at the hub, and if the patient indeed needs to be stabilized once again at the hub, that can occur for weeks or months, whatever is needed.
Dr. Levine, let me ask you a question. You have obviously have a long history in primary care, as do I. And when you talk about, there is a movement now to get more primary care providers qualified or have the waiver to provide Suboxone. Right now, I believe it's about an eight-hour teaching certificate that you get in order to qualify, and it's being discussed about maybe reducing that in order to try and get more people prescribing. You mentioned that someone with opioid use disorder on Suboxone may be sitting next to someone with a simple cold or something. Opioid use disorder can kill people quickly, really as quickly or quicker than a heart attack can. As physicians, we're taught in medical school and residency how to take care of heart attacks and blood clots to the lung and other things that can kill people quickly. At least in my training, we did not get anywhere near enough training on how to take care of opioid use disorder, how to spot the warning signs that someone may be slipping or using again. Does it worry you at all to have more and more providers who may not have extensive training taking care of these folks?
No, it actually doesn't. And I think the transition to allowing people to prescribe buprenorphine without getting that special waiver has already occurred at the level of the federal government. So that will encourage more to participate in the treatment system. If you think about it, it's often compared to what kind of training did a doctor get for prescribing medications for pain. And it turns out that though we were told that we were under-treating pain and needed to be more aggressive with it, we weren't exactly given all of the skills necessary to do that in a competent fashion. So the reality is one can learn how to use buprenorphine in your practice without necessarily going to the extent of that waiver. Plus, newer trainees are having more extensive training done at the level of medical school and residency, which was missing when you and I were in our training at that time. So that's really important to know.
Well, you made two points. One is that the training is now more extensive in medical school and residency, but the other point, I think, comes back to what I just said, is that we were not educated enough to know that some of these medications were dangerous that we were prescribing. And I do worry to some extent that as people who have not been in medical school recently begin prescribing these medications without extensive training, without perhaps even the 8 hours that's now required, that they're going to miss something, and that missing that something could be devastating.
Well, that's one of the benefits of the hub and spoke, is that there's ready access to addiction medicine specialists, so that if questions occur or problems in the management of a specific patient occur, there is that bidirectional process for either having the patient transition or just getting the advice one needs from the hub.
Dr.
So
King, I'm sorry, because we just have a short period before the break. Dr. King, let me ask your opinion on that. Would you support widespread prescribing of Suboxone by primary care providers of various levels of training?
Yeah, actually, I think I'm tracking with everybody else here. I would. I do share your concerns. I do agree with you that we don't do enough training on this with primary care providers, although some programs now, some of the providers getting out are now starting to get a little bit more training on that. However, I have yet to see a patient die because they were improperly treated in primary care. I've seen a lot of patients that died because they didn't get any treatment at all. So a lot of rural communities, we don't have your hub and spoke. We don't have that ready access. We've got to make do with what we've got.
Well, that's helpful to hear from both of you, and that does seem to be a direction we are moving in. Briefly, Dr. Levine, the difference between methadone and Suboxone.
Sure.
And it'll have to be brief, I'm sorry.
Briefly, without getting too biochemical about it. Suboxone, it's the way these drugs work on receptors in the brain. The receptors that make you feel good when you get the opioid of your choice and that give you that pleasure, but that also, unfortunately, wants you to get more and more because the level of addiction begins to rise.
Dr. Levine, we have a lot of ground to cover in our second half, so then I'll ask you briefly. You mentioned that methadone is prescribed through the hubs in Vermont and Suboxone can be prescribed through the spokes, which is often primary care. How do you or how do clinicians decide who to put on methadone and who to put on Suboxone?
Some of the major ways have to do with the depth and pervasiveness of the addiction problem in the individual and all of the circumstances surrounding that problem regarding their greater life, how intense their treatment needs to be. So if there's a lot of supervision needed, patients are having a lot of challenge, methadone can be a superior drug. It's a much older drug. It was originally used as a pain reliever itself. It needs to be titrated very carefully and monitored very carefully. It's administered daily, and patients traditionally will go to the hub each day. Buprenorphine, on the other hand, is for a patient who's more stable, who may have less other issues going on that require constant supervision. And it has what's called a ceiling effect, which means that once you get a certain dosage threshold, the opioid effect plateaus even if the individual takes more of the medication. So it really reduces the risk of misuse and side effects. Methadone would be regarded as a little bit more dangerous than that because it doesn't have that kind of ceiling effect. So buprenorphine is safer. Traditionally, the person at the spoke level who's getting buprenorphine might get a prescription once a month and be trusted to be able to use that prescription in the way it was prescribed, as opposed to the methadone patient at the hub who may be coming on a daily basis to get their dose.
And I think the bottom line is that it helps people to continue their lives. It helps them to continue working. It helps them stabilize their family situations so that these are important and probably help save their life in many instances. So these are very, very important services. And if someone is out there struggling with their addiction, we encourage you to seek either through your primary care or directly through the addiction center to get help, because it's there. Dr. Levine, one of the reasons why their opioid overdoses have soared in Vermont is that most of the heroin is now spiked with fentanyl, which is a much more potent opioid and is even more difficult to reverse than heroin. What can we do about that?
That's such a challenge now. Almost every, in my estimation, almost everything coming into the state is tainted with fentanyl in some way or another. And sometimes it's one of the more primary ingredients in it. The problem is, if you're purchasing a powder that looks like all other powders and you're thinking it's heroin, it probably is not. It probably has a lot of fentanyl. It may not even have any heroin in it. But there are also people who are using, as Dr. King was pointing out, stimulant drugs. There are times that an opioid overdose death is actually only labeled an opioid overdose death because fentanyl was in the mixture. But the person was purchasing it because they thought they were purchasing cocaine or some other stimulant, and the fentanyl was even mixed in with that. So that's the concern, is that there's obviously no Food and Drug Administration behind the illicit purchases that are being made for these drugs. And without any regulation of any sort, one never knows what one's buying. That's one of the reasons why when we give people these take-home packs, which have Narcan, have instructions about how to manage overdose, how to prevent overdose, they also include a test strip for fentanyl, so that the person using that powder can know right from the get-go, is there fentanyl in this or not? That's been a very effective tool. The problem with it now, I believe, is that you almost have to exercise universal precautions, which means assume everything has fentanyl, because it's in such a high percentage of the drugs coming into the state of Vermont that you would be foolish to not assume what you're using doesn't have fentanyl in it and pay serious consequences for that decision.
Unfortunately, I've heard from some people who are addicted that they will actually seek out fentanyl because they feel that it gives a bigger high, even knowing that it may cost them their lives. Dr. King, are you having a problem with fentanyl out in the Midwest?
Of course, air proximity to Cincinnati meant that we actually were having significant issues with carfentanil for a while, which is actually a veterinary a large animal tranquilizer, which is significantly more deadly than regular fentanyl. So we've seen both, unfortunately. But yeah, I think another issue that probably we don't talk about enough is the addiction to benzodiazepines. We often joke that it's the soccer mom drug. You know, you have a lot of people who are very high functioning who use that, and then now that we're starting to get some attention on the addictive properties of that, they're being cut off, and people who you would never in a million years would think would be, you know, partaking of Xanax in the street are now buying it from their friends and family members, and this is really problematic because there is a huge scourge of fake Xanax right now that is laced with fentanyl, and I tell you, I've seen the dupes, they're so close you can't tell. You absolutely can't tell. Even medical professionals can't tell. They look exactly like regular Xanax. And, of course, these are people without a significant drug use history. So even a small amount of fentanyl can be deadly. And these are people that we don't typically reach with this education, because a lot of the people that I see that are buying Xanax from friends and family members are people who would not consider themselves substance users or in that community. And so any messaging that you put out just goes right over their head.
And it's particularly important because both benzodiazepines and opioids depress the respiratory system. So that means that people are going to breathe less often and less deeply. And that's essentially what often kills people in opioid overdoses, is the respiratory depression. This brings me to another question. Dr. Levine, you mentioned sending people home with packages, and including fentanyl strips. There has been discussion in Vermont about whether or not to establish safe injection sites, and I'll put quotations around that. These would be sites in areas where we know there's high opioid use, and there would be some professional there, whether it's a paraprofessional or a fully licensed professional, who would be there to be able to administer Narcan, to be able to give clean needles. This Vermont's not the only place in the country this is being discussed, although I don't think, other than some very isolated communities, that it has really caught on. I know Governor Scott has not been in favor of this. What are your thoughts?
Generally, in Vermont, we've not been in favor. We've done a fair amount of literature review and research on this. You know, Canada and Australia are places that we have to draw upon their experience. Not a lot in the U.S. Philadelphia was trying to get this off the ground, and I believe it got caught up in the courts a bit. And I'm not sure if it's actually off the ground now or not in that city, but it isn't widespread through the country yet. These facilities are meant to allow someone to essentially inject their drugs under observation, have a period of time where they can remain and continue to be observed until everyone knows they're safe and able to leave. The problem I see it as is people are using heroin at the, you know, frequency of 4 or 5 times in a day. The person can't possibly live in this facility. So while you will find in the literature there have been no deaths in the facilities, places like Vancouver, the hottest part of town for overdose deaths and for medication overuse in general, is in the vicinity of the facility. That's why it was located there, to try to help that part of the woods. And it doesn't really change the total impact on overdose death rates and use of medications in those neighborhoods. So, yes, if you're inside the building, people will rescue you and you will not die from what you just injected. But that can't happen 24/7 every day of the year for that individual or any other individuals. So it's a real challenge when you're thinking about the millions of dollars that are spent to set up a facility like this, to say that that might be a better solution or another part of the armamentarium, when we can spend our money on so many other evidence-based things that seem to have much clearer track record.
And speaking of that, Dr. King, I'll turn to you. A number of communities, perhaps even more communities than are setting up safe injection, but a number of communities are decriminalizing opioid use and diverting people into drug courts. What are your thoughts about that?
Absolutely critical, and needs to be wider spread than it is. I think one of the issues that I have had with drug courts is that a lot of times the courts themselves are put on the spot to hire their own treatment provider, either because there's no other treatment providers that they can partner with realistically in rural communities, or something about the way the drug court itself is set up. So first, that's cost prohibitive for a lot of small communities. And second of all, that really continues to segregate mental health care out from whole body health care, which I think is possibly the biggest crime of the 21st and 20th century. You know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest came out, and I always blame that movie. But, you know, we got this idea that inpatient mental health is bad, and that mental health is this super secretive thing that just needs to be done in private. And we separated out these mental health centers from regular health care. And the problem is that, you know, I think in medical school you learn about systems, body systems, integumentary system, digestive system. Well, that's all wrong. It's all connected. Mm-hmm. Your head is part of your body. I mean, that doesn't, you wouldn't think you need to say that, but apparently you do. And separating out psychiatry and putting the notes down under lock and key, while it helps protect patient privacy, is really a huge barrier to providing quality care. And so I think that we absolutely need more drug courts. We absolutely need to decriminalize, but we also need to integrate mental health care treatment and pull it out of the prison. Because when we decommissioned the inpatient mental health hospitals in the 70s, all we really did was put them in the prisons instead.
Thank you for those thoughts. That is an interesting, I think, helpful perspective. Dr. Levine, back to you for a minute. In the early 1970s, there was discussion that marijuana was a gateway drug. Dr. Robert DuPont, who was then head of the National Institute of Drug and Alcohol, that was sort of his mantra. We have legalized small amounts of cannabis in Vermont. There are now people who suggest that it actually helps reduce addiction. What are your thoughts?
Unfortunately, it's hard to weigh in on this and come firmly on one side or the other, especially in light of some of the literature that's out there. So I think everyone is right. There are people who are on a ongoing cascade of going from one substance to the next to the next. But there are also people who clearly are finding marijuana as a way to find a new drug that works for them that doesn't have perhaps some of the danger of opioid use and opioid overdose. Not that I'm endorsing that by any means, because the fact of the matter is there is appropriate use and there's misuse of medications, and we know of many, many complications of chronic marijuana use, so I don't want to parade around saying that that's a safe alternative by any means. There is a whole entity known as cannabis overuse disorder. There are very serious impacts in our adolescents on their brain development and on their attentiveness in school, things of that sort. One of the tragedies of the pandemic has been in our adolescents and young adults, we found that there was a turning to marijuana at a higher rate than pre-pandemic as a means of coping with the stress of the pandemic.
We're going to have I'm going to try and devote an entire show to research that's been done on cannabis, and perhaps we will have you back a third time for that. I did want to ask you this, Dr. Levine. I started in the beginning of the show, and we talked about how physicians probably contributed to this problem by prescribing some of these strong opioid pain medications in large amounts. There's been a dramatic change, and I think it started about 10 years ago with increased education, increased public awareness, and increased legal concerns. Physicians and other providers have really decreased prescribing opioid pain medications to the point where many of them will not prescribe them at all. And there is a question, and I hear this from patients who have severe chronic pain, true chronic pain from various, you know, real conditions, that they cannot get their pain treated at this point. They go in and they're given either Tylenol or some Advil and a pat in the back. Are we under-treating pain at this point? Has the pendulum swung too much the other way?
First, let me just refer to the first part of what you said so the listeners are all aware. We have a prescription drug monitoring program in Vermont, and there's a prescriber rule that really puts some restrictions on clinicians' ability to prescribe in the way they might have done in an earlier era. That has been very successful in terms of reducing the amount of prescription opioids that are in the population per capita. We've leveled off kind of at a newer level that's much lower than the earlier level. And what we've seen is prescription drugs are no longer the main reason people are dying of overdoses. It's really the injected drugs that are illicit.
And Dr. King actually mentioned that, I think, just before he came on, that the problem in Kentucky and perhaps Indiana arose when people could no longer get pain medication through a prescriber.
Yes. So I mean, we've done some real good there, and I don't want to underestimate that. However, with regard to your question, the reality is that there is a population of patients with chronic pain that I know we need to do a better job with. Now, a better job doesn't necessarily mean maintaining their opioid prescriptions or increasing them, but we really need to do something that was starting out pre-pandemic, and now we need to find a way to get back to it, which are these pain management centers that really are multimodality and bring in specialists of all sorts, whether they be psychotherapists, chiropractors, acupuncturists, other types of Eastern and Asian forms of pain treatment. These things really need to be offered on a broader scale, because problem was the physician had little else to work with other than their prescription pad for management of patients with chronic pain. And we need to now explore things that are not only prescription drugs, and certainly not prescription narcotic drugs, but other modalities. And so that whole movement, if you will, has begun, but it was kind of interrupted at the time and point where people couldn't leave their house to go keep an appointment somewhere or manage things in the more innovative ways I'm talking about.
Well, as we near the end of our hour, I did want to, that brings me to one of my final questions. The opioid overdose fatalities in Vermont almost doubled, I think, during COVID. And I think there are many reasons for that have been suggested. But one of the reasons has been perhaps that people were not able to see their, physically go to the treatment centers. They were not being monitored as closely. Is there anything we've learned during this COVID pandemic that we might do differently next time?
Yeah, there was a 38% increase in our overdose deaths over the course of the pandemic. Very serious, especially because it followed on the heels of the first year we actually had a nice decrease and thought we were going in the right direction. So it wasn't access to treatment that was the problem as much. It turns out that over the course of the pandemic, people could still go to the hubs. Their federal laws were created to allow buprenorphine prescribing at the smokes in a more expansive way without actually a face-to-face visit and for a long period of time. So treatment was not the issue so much. Part of it was recovery centers weren't functioning the way they used to function because their doors had to be closed for a period of time. Part of it was the fact that people who were using intravenous drugs were doing it alone, doing it at a higher rate to deal with the stress of the pandemic, not having a buddy there to rescue them with Narcan, with a call to 911, what have you. And they were using powders that were unknown to them because their usual supply routes had changed during the pandemic. So a lot of problems that hopefully we won't face again, that we can now return to some of the very innovative ways we've been trying to reduce overdose deaths, with these to-go packs, with a stigma campaign, with what's called rapid access to medication-assisted treatment, meaning if you do have an overdose and you're brought to an emergency room, you have an offer right then and there to get your first dose of buprenorphine, which could be life-saving for you at that time.
I think the take-home message from Dr. Levine is the treatment is out there. We have a robust treatment environment in Vermont, and we want you to seek treatment if you're suffering from opioid addiction. This is a life-threatening disease, and we want you to stay alive. Dr. King, I'm going to give you the last word. What keeps you going?
Honestly, it sounds really cheesy, but our patients are awesome. Our providers are awesome. Our team is awesome. I think that we can make a difference. I think this is going to get better. I hear a lot of people say this is never getting better. You know, the opioid epidemic just gets worse every year. And, you know, I think it can. I think we've been working in a mental health system that's been very fragmented and broken for a long time, but we can get it back on the rails. I think the best is yet to come.
Well, thank goodness that we have people like Dr. Nikki King, who has never left, her heart never left Appalachia, and she's helping the people that need it there. And thank you to Dr. Levine. Dr. Levine, we hope to have you back again. There are so many more topics we want to discuss, and I know you're quite busy, but we always appreciate your time. I'm going to be away for the next 2 weeks in midsummer. We come back on July 16th. We're going to be talking with Northern Vermont Poison Control about poisons to avoid and what to do if you get poisoned. And we're going to be talking with our public health expert on summertime emergencies. So please join us then. Be kind to yourselves. Be kind to others.